Welcome again at the stage one of the Chaos Congress, Chaos Communication Congress of 2024. And I'm very happy you're here because we're speaking about a topic, that in the last few years got a lot of traction. And Marcello, who will be introducing the topic to us, he's here for many years already, and he's also part of the screen printing area, so you can find him there later, and there are some screen printing fans or colleagues, amazing. And yeah, Marcello did actually his PhD here in Hamburg, and then now works in Seattle as a postdoc, and he realized that, neurodiversity is something prevalent, very interesting, especially here in the Chaos community. We also see this because you're all here. And like 2 years ago, he got diagnosed himself with ADHD, and he was working already on autism spectrum disorders. So that was all super interesting for him. And then he realized everyone here is super interested in these topics, so it should happen on the main stage. So thank you all for joining us, and this is your applause, Marcello.
All right, thanks for the nice introduction. Yeah, I'm very happy to be here. A little bit intimidated by this big, massive room, but it's, I think we might make it. Yeah, all brains are beautiful, pretty much. Before I start, where is it? There's this. Ah, resume slideshow. Yeah, I want that. Okay, cool. Before I start, I want to start with a disclaimer. So yeah, I did my PhD in molecular neurobiology. I am not a psychiatrist, so I'm not a medical doctor. And since this is such a big field, so of science, I tried to connect very recent findings with some translatable knowledge from other papers and out of model systems and current theories to just get a bigger overview of what's very recent. And I will simplify a lot, and I definitely cannot cover everything because it's pretty big. And yeah, as I said, like, I have ADHD, so I'm bad with time management, and I might sometimes can drift off, so yeah, just want to say that. Diving directly into, so I think most of you who read a little about university or maybe got some memes on the internet, you have seen this picture of the umbrella, so basically a neurodiversity umbrella. So what is neurodiversity? It covers basically a lot of things that we see that are different from the neurotypical brain, and this can be dyscalculia, synesthesia, epilepsy, bipolar disorder, but also can be being left-handed or being ambidextrous, like actually I am. But most people use this term for actually autism or ADHD, and this is also what I will mainly focus on because the research is the most dominant here. So neurodiversity, it's kind of a new term, but kind of an old story. So the new term, the term was coined by Judy Singer in the late 90s to promote a sense of equality for neuro-minorities. And I think a really good definition is actually found on Wikipedia. So the neurodiversity paradigm is a framework for understanding human brain function that recognizes the diversity with sensory processing, motor abilities, social comfort, cognition, and focus as new biological differences. So you can think a little bit about diversity in the gender spectrum as a similarity. A neurodivergent brain basically uses a significant different strategy than a neurotypical brain to navigate its surroundings and also the inner surrounding and complete thoughts or tasks. And a little terminology here, so neurodiversity is not neurodivergent. So what is actually, are these two words? So neurodiversity says basically that within a population of humans, like in this room, we have a lot of different brains, a lot of different brain architectures, and thereby find some that are different, significantly different from others. Neurodivergence basically said that a new minority is divergent from the big population. So it's
you can basically think of statistics that we have a big population that is more typical, like more closer to the mean in a Gaussian distribution, and we have those that are on the outside of the Gaussian distribution because they are, their traits are different and more diverge, less typical to the population. And this, of course, can change when you look at different populations, for instance, from different countries or different parts of the world. But it's not just one curve. Of course, neurodivergencies can be very different, can have vast different genetic backgrounds, so it's more like a spectrum and a spectrum and a spectrum, and only one axis here is not enough, so we actually think of like multiple axes here that can shift this whole curves. Yeah, and you know this saying, like, but isn't everyone a little human? Yeah, duh. So everyone is human because actually neurodivergent traits are human traits. So everyone forgets, but I, for instance, like I forget all the time or like come too late all the time. So it's more about like the controllability and the times we do a thing or do not a thing and how much energy it costs us and how natural it feels to do it. So everyone can socialize, but some are totally drained after it and some get the energy out of it. So we are actually humans. So very important is like we actually perceive, so when I say we, I say like neurodivergent community, perceive things differently and why, I will get closer into that. And so the neurodivergent brain can, but not necessarily have to be perceived as a disability. It's very important because some people see like, oh yeah, it works fine for me. And some others are totally out of the world and think like they suffer a lot, and that's all respectable because each experience is valid. The etiology, so the reasons, the causes of why our brains are different are extremely diverse. So I want to have a quick look on actually the biased science, because science is always a little bit biased, and I have to talk about this here because it's very important. So scientific research about things like autism or ADHD or other neurodivergencies are biases by the diagnosis criteria, which have changed over the years a lot, and also by social stigma. We have a publication bias as scientists, so we want to publish things that are interesting, that are significant, and that people will click, and if it's not interesting enough, we might not publish it. And scientists also use a lot of constructed model systems. So they have a mouse, they knock out a gene, and then, oh, it doesn't socialize with the other mouse, so that gene must be something have to do with autism. So there's a lot of construction behind it. So we have to be careful with that, reading papers, and keep that in mind, that all scientific research tries to look at like big differences often. And so the tiny differences that are actually important for us might not be overlooked. And we have a survivorship bias. For instance, like papers say, like, oh, we tested patients in this clinic, but think of like, okay, what does it need to go to a clinic if you have ADHD or if you have any other neurodivergent disease? So the level of suffering has to be quite high, and so you might look at other things or overlook things that are subclinical. The focus was historically mostly on children, especially boys, so we have a huge gender bias and age bias here, and still is mostly. And the clinical criteria and subclinical features are sometimes different. So a lot of medical papers, they focus on focus or attention spans or social interaction, etc. But other things that are not really looked into. So it's the questions like, what is of interest in science? So in this talk, I will talk mostly or in perspective of ADHD and autism, but other things are translatable. Why do I do that? Choose these two? Because, they have some similarities in traits. For instance, hyperfocus, they can coexist with paradoxical traits. So for instance, having a strong need for order, but not being able to keep it. They have some similarities and risk factors. For instance, one is like maternal information. So when someone is being is pregnant and having a disease or some infection, this can kick on high inflammation levels and correlates with developing ADHD or autism in the developing child. And a lot of genes in those two we know are playing a role in synaptic connectivity, neurodevelopment, inflammation, immune system, and also neurodegeneration. So there's a vast amount of genes here. The ICD, so the ICD, basically the catalog of diagnostic criteria for different diseases and disorders, have been renewed. So this now we have from ICD 10 to 11 in 2022, but it has a transition phase for 5 years. So before ICD-11, they were not considered as new developmental disorders. And also, it was excluded that you can have autism and ADHD at the same time. So it's quite old. And when you look at those diagnosis criteria, you see like, oh, that's not what the realities look like. So the community has a lot of criticism there. And now they, in 2022, they aligned it to the DSM-5, which is the American standard. And it's still not perfect, but it's much, much better. The transition period of the 5 years means doctors can still diagnose you or not, or exclude diagnoses because of the old criteria. So this is very important. If you ever go to a doctor and once you have any diagnosis, just ask them to check for the ICD-11 or just if what kind of standards they use. Prevalence. So we nowadays, papers vary a bit different, but we have one out of 36 people get diagnosed with autism and one out of 10 to 20 with ADHD. And interestingly, about 28% of the people that get diagnosed with autism also get diagnosed with ADHD, so they will achieve ADHD, they have both, and 20 to 50% same for ADHD, so they have a huge overlap here. And in autism, we have one of 36 genes that are linked, somehow known that they interact in from studies, and 27 in ADHD, but mostly are not really well described what they actually do. So we know what they do in the molecular sense or in other diseases or whatever, but we don't know what they do in our, in this case. The most recent, or like not recent, but like up-to-date theory, what autism is basically called the intense world theory. So that this is just basically a relatively normal brain, but it just experience the world much more intense than the neurotypical brain, and thereby each autistic behavior is just a normal reaction just to an intense world. In autism and ADHD, we both find a highly diverse spectrum, so one is not like the other, and most likely we will have see further subcategories in the future. And in both, we see that dopamine, norepinephrine, and serotonin pathways are disrupted. So these are three neurotransmitters, very mainly. And you can think of like dopamine, we hear a lot, but it has more than just one function. So it's mostly reward, but also motivation. Norepinephrine is doing the thing you want to do, so execution. Serotonin basically having the satisfaction, but all three also are important for learning memory. And we have some well-established medication for ADHD. For autism, you basically nowadays get a high five and that's it. But it's also important to think about. There's so much medication, so many things to do. But in a brain that is really physically different, substances can work differently. So many of you might notice that, oh, when I drink coffee, I actually get calm or even tired. And so we see that the substances work different from our brain, and same as this for stimulant medication or other medication. So also if you have a major surgery, tell your doctor that you have ADHD or autism or when you have it. To get a little overview of what's happened in the past, so this is for ADHD, but you can basically see similar things for autism that has been described hundreds of years ago. Like 1775 was first described, and we got a strong, long history of things that happened in clinical milestones and research milestones. For instance, important to see is like here on the bottom is that methylphenidate has been synthesized and in the 40s, and before it was first described that, oh, stimulants kind of work, amphetamines kind of work with ADHD here. And yeah, of course, there were other interests during that period for stimulants. But later, then Ritalin has been approved by the FDA. And since then, the categories what ADHD is, but also actually for autism, have been changed a lot. And yeah, nowadays, we find more and more genes that are making things different. So let's dive into it. What's actually is different. So what makes our brain work differently here? And before I drink a little. Okay, so to think of like our brain is the basis of everything that we perceive. So it's the basis of making sense of what we perceive inside our body and outside our body. So the light that we see, the feelings that we feel, the sounds that we hear, etc. So we have sensory and stimuli that we process from the outside world. This is like vision, but also touch, smell, sounds that we listen, etc., but also inside. There's one sense that not a lot of people know. It's called proprioception, so that my body always knows where my body is, like where my hand is. When you're a drunk driving and the police stops you, they want to make you through this test. So basically that your brain knows that your fingers are here and not here. And this can happen that you sometimes are clumsy, run into things when this is a little bit disrupted. But also our thoughts and feelings and memory are basically stimuli in our brain that we kind of sense from the network and can react to it. And you can also think of like consciousness as kind of a sense of feeling that we are we and we are alive. Yeah, and this input sensitivity can be very different for people. So sometimes those little noises can annoy you a little bit. And also, sensory input can depend a lot on context. So the same thing can feel very differently. For instance, here, the shower, I can relate a lot to this meme, actually. And there has been a theory lately, which I find very interesting, that tries to explain how autism works, but I think it's also translatable to other things. And it's called monotropism. So that we basically find different strategies, so our brain finds different strategies to cope with an abundance of input. Because if you think of like everything that we see, everything that we hear, is just a minority of what actually is coming into our brain. And also not from the outside, but also from the inside. Because we have all the memories there all the time and all the feelings all there all the time, but we're not feeling them all the time. I mean, some of us actually do, and this is quite exhausting. Anyway, so and our brain can pay attention. It's funny because in English it's paying attention, so it's you'll see what I mean. So that our brain pays attention to certain sensory stimuli that come in. And you can think of, this is a nice quote, so it's generally accepted that focus is a quality of attention. However, this optical metaphor may be extended to parameterize focus of attention between diffuse light and at one extreme and a torch beam, a laser, at the other. So you can think of like this. So we have a certain bag of attention coins and in a polytrophic case, we have a lot of signals input into the brain from the inside, from the outside, and we pay attention to some of them, and the rest we can ignore. And so basically, right now I hear my voice, I see the lights, but I can ignore other things. And an autistic person, the theory says basically, oh, it's more like monotrophic, so we pay most or all of our attention to this one thing, which can be our interest or our focus onto one spot. So we can blend everything out. This is why often like parents, when they think, oh, my child might be autistic, they see that because they speak to them and they, oh, this child is not listening. But it can listen, but it's just focusing so deep onto one thing that it just basically ignores the other. Another quote, which I think depicts it quite well, is, for example, so it's an autistic person that says, for example, I need to look at what people's bodies are doing and what their facial expressions I need to hear their words and process the whole event. I also need to consider my part in any interaction. And then I need to decide if I should respond to something. After all of this, I have to work out what my response should be. And I often get this wrong because at times my attention is elsewhere focused and I miss the context, content and context of events. Due to this difficulty, I avoid social situations that are not within my control. And there's also thoughts if this concept could also be fit for ADHD. So maybe it's just jumping monotrophic. So that ADHD basically switches around all the time and that we get distracted. Okay, I have to speed a little up here. So what's the underlying basis? There's the current theory is that basically neural activity for stimulus is selected through modification of synchrony and firing patterns. So neurons are very diverse. They can look very diverse. And when we look at our brain focus, we have those intense amount of connections, an intense amount of neurons, actually. And an oversimplified neurons always have a receiving side and a sending side, so sending signals and connected via an axon, basically. And science basically has found out that each level of this can be affected in neurodivergencies, so that each signal and structure, there can be receptors that are different in levels or amount. To simplify that, we just use this structure for a neuron. And so if you look at neuronal networks, because you basically could have a signal neuron that signals to another, and we get a stimulus and get basically to action. And they can be also co-stimuli. So if you things that are kind of in common or similar, or even the same sense by different neurons, and they can then activate each other and increase the overall action output. But we can also have the opposite. We can have a counter-stimulus that activates inhibitory neurons, which are actually GABAergic, and they basically block the function of another network. And these networks can actually feed themselves forward, so they can activate themselves and kind of pump them up. But they also have feedback circuits that basically block their action and then inhibit that it's not overpowering. And so this control about excitation in networks and inhibition, we found actually is deregulated in ADHD and autism and also others. Which in the end results that, into a thing that if we have a comprehensive stimuli in a neurotypical case, is that we get a lot of synchrony in those firing patterns in small networks, and that this synchrony basically enhances the output. So you can think of like small network units, and if they're kind of doing the same thing, it's like a football, soccer stadium. So if everyone, like a few people start to sing, and then some people would do with it, and then in the end, the whole stadium sings. And this leads to increased action. But high synchrony can also block out noise, so from other networks. Oh, there's some input here. I hear something, but my brain is capable to actually block it out, so I'm not consciously aware of what's happening. But too much high synchrony is seen, for instance, in things like epilepsy, so we need to keep this in a balance. And if it's not synchronous, basically we get lower action. And it's all about synchrony that basically decides in which way to go. And this sensory processing can also be disrupted, which ends up in something like this. So someone asks you what time it is, and you're like, oh, what? And then before they ask the question again, you already answer, because the processing is actually a little bit delayed because of this inhibitory feedback circles. Okay, so multiple of those small circuits can build a super circuit. So there can be some circuits that, for instance, receive stimulus A, others stimulus B, and stimulus C, and they can kind of all interact with each other. So this can be things like, oh, I'm actually quite thirsty, which I'm actually right now are. And there can be memories from past events and excitement about the this event. And feelings and thoughts can come out of it, so I should drink a chunk. So, but modality changes can switch the networks from synchrony to asynchrony. So, you want to drink a chunk, but actually I have to pee, so I go to pee in a neurotypical case. So sometimes it can be that you actually, have to pee, but you focus so much on the thing you want to do when your network works a little bit different, actually. And it also helps us to understand complex sensory inputs. So we can have worse facial recognition and sensory social context, and then respond to what the conversation is. And if it's all in synchrony, that works quite well. But if it's not in synchrony, because there are so many other networks that's also communicating with it or blocking it, then it's like, oh, I just feel so overwhelmed by this. And it's in the end a decision what we're paying attention to. So, for instance, you can have the intent to lean on something, and you feel what the surface is like, and it feels good, it feels flat, satisfaction to do that, okay, the network goes out, but actually it's a hot plate. So this will say like, oh no, stop, there's no satisfaction, we switch off this this network, there's strong attention to this focus, and you get it out. And since hot plate is a very dominant one, it has such a strong power, but this can also mean that in neurodivergent brains, things like a tickle on your shirt or something that's normally, or in a typical case, considered as not important, can be very important to you and block other things. So you can't focus on these things because your clothes have a feeling on your body. Okay, and all those synchrony, all those oscillations, we can actually record, and that's what we actually know as brainwaves. So different parts of brains have different oscillations, and we can record that. And if people find out that dopamine is one of the major neurotransmitters that regulates this oscillatory synchrony in the brain. So that kind of makes sense that if we lack our dopamine, that we have a problem to regulate the synchrony here. And inhibitory feedback is important at all levels. So that's why people also found out that GABAergic neurons actually are enables inhibitory control over unwanted thoughts. So that's why people with autism or ADHD have more intrusive thoughts that just push through, and normally they would be pushed away. It's like, oh, no, that's not important. And also in other disorders. So what happens when we're idle? So normally, in a neurotypical case, the brain is active at most times. And but even when idle, autistic brains process and create much more information than neurotypical brains. So we just overanalyze everything. And during an idle mode, normally the brain goes into a system where it's called the default mode network. The default mode network is the network of different parts in your brain that is important for a default mode, where we mind wander, self-reflect. And you could actually see that people with ADHD, autism, but also in depression, spend more time in this network. But so they self-reflect more, they have more deep thoughts, they overanalyze things. And normally this is suppressed by certain tasks, if those task suppression does not work so well, we spend more time in it. And higher activity there correlates also with symptoms in attention and impulsivity. And this network is also actually found to be responsible for internal narrative. And that's actually funny when you ask someone, oh, what's your internal narrative like? And they're like, I don't have an internal narrative. Because some people don't, and some people have multiple voices at the same time. So, and that's kind of interesting to think like, okay, how do people think? So they have, yeah, it can be very different. Okay, meditation can help to regulate the DMN, so the default mode network, but basically also helps with oscillation synchrony. But there's also other things that help. Who doesn't know what that is? Is psilocybin. So psilocybin strongly decreases functional connectivity to the default mode network. So people found out that all those activity that basically this mind wandering is kind of controlled with psilocybin, and that other unwanted interaction with this can be reduced. And before the end, so I want to say actually two last things. One other theory is that there is something called like local sleep. What's local sleep? So we don't even know what sleep is actually, so we still don't exactly know. And traditionally sleep and wakefulness have been considered as two global mutually exclusive states, but recently in the few years we found out that actually some small circuits can fall into sleep mode. And this happens in every brain all the time. But it seems that be disrupted in things like ADHD, so that we sometimes mind blank, because a certain part of our brain just goes into sleep mode, and we don't know what we wanted to do. This is kind of late. I'll just skip this more. Okay, so last thing. Since those are neurodevelopment disorders, what happens during neurodevelopment? During neurodevelopment, actually, all those neurons are growing the network, connect to others. And you see here in the middle, during childhood, where ADHD and autism basically is the age of onset, the neurons have the most most spread out dendritic trees and most connections, and later they are kind of pruned down. So all those processes that include like growth and connectivity are kind of very important. And this was actually one part of my PhD, that we looked into synaptic connectivity during those growth periods. And we found that there are activity dependent, and there are certain genes that regulate those things. So normally when in the case we have what fires together, wires together, so neurons are of the same kind, they fire together and they kind of find their partner, etc. But we found out that this is regulated by certain genes that are activity dependent. And we have, for instance, here we looked at sensory neurons for like simple touch, but also nociceptive, which feel like pain. But pain is just emotion, anyways. So we found out that when those neurons grow during development and those networks grow, that normally they discriminate so that one sense is not mixed with the other. But if there are certain genes, which are also actually linked to autism, that control this spatial growth and this discrimination, and when they are worked a little bit differently, then they can actually connect to the other network. Now I needed a pointer to show that the red one, the blue one are actually connected. And so now when the simple touch neuron fire, the animal would respond and feel like, oh, that's actually pain. So, and we know this term actually called synesthesia, when different senses are interconnected, hardwired, and we can feel different things. So this is not only for touch and pain, etc. This can be anything. It's kind of also like internal network sort. Okay, and since this is activity dependent, we need a certain activity that that the networks grow right. I mean, what is right? That they grow in a certain direction. One example, for instance, if you have chickens in an egg and they grow, so the embryo, and grows further, at a certain time it needs the sound of the mother for that the auditory system develops right enough that they can later distinguish their mother's voice in the herd. So if you put place the egg in another place, then they can't find the mother. It's because in the herd, because their auditory system is just not growing right in the right way. So we need a certain activity. But in this growing, even in genetically identical animals, under the same conditions, we find a lot of variance. So there's a lot of stochastic variability, which means that every one of us is kind of different, of course. And this is, even if we were like identical twins, there is some variability in how we perceive that. And of course, external factors can also have strong effects. I talked about inflammation before, because inflammation actually helps the brain. So the immune system in the brain helps to regulate this growth. And there's not too much growth, not too little growth. And if this is changed a little due to an infection or something, then it kind of have a vast effect on how our neurons interact with each other. Overall, we still know too little. And there's a huge variability in the spectrum. So, as I said, genetics are very different. And the local roles and difference in neurotransmitters are unclear, because sometimes we talk about dopamine all the time, but dopamine in different regions can have different effects, and also found to be sometimes elevated in some parts in ADHD brains. But so we still don't know everything about that. And a lot of research has been done, and in the best case, actually with the community. Because we have been excluded for a long, long time. And this is actually the end. Thank you. Thanks.
I need to switch it on. Thank you, Marcelo. That was really nice. Thank you all for being here. I think we have time for one question, maybe two. So I already see people, and I also see the Signal Angel having a lot of questions. So microphone one, please.
What are, according to you, the advantages of autism and ADHD? And might you find an explanation in there for the high prevalence of neurodiversity in the hacker community?
Oh, interesting. Yeah, it's actually a good question. I actually also want to talk about that. So people say that advantages are deep thoughts, strong memories, for instance, and such intensity with the detail that other people might overlook. That is one thing, like for instance for autism, and that neurotypical brains might lack. So they would never look so detailed into a certain project and get so determined on solving a certain puzzle. So we might never have come so far as a society in developing things if people would not be so determined on doing things. And for ADHD is rapid task switching. We are really good when it's about stress. When there's a stressful situation, we thrive often and can handle all those things. And so people have the theory that ADHD and autism are things that popped up when populations of humans basically got social, because we have a huge advantage for the social community to be adapted to switching environments. And yeah.
Thank you. One question from the Signal Angel.
Yes. The internet wonders what is the classes of evidence around these whole gene things. Are these just genome-wide association studies, actual models, or is there a broader field of evidence?
So yeah, it gets complex, because we don't look into brains of humans under the microscope, because we cannot do that without damaging the brain. Most of those molecular studies or imaging studies are done in animal models or in vitro cultures. But the oscillation we can do, like recording of brain waves, etc., and we can do it with patients and humans. So all this evidence here is basically a mix of recent observation in human studies, knowledge that we have for decades or recent in animal models, and basically trying to connect these together with molecular studies that we have also from other model systems. So what I try to do here is connecting different parts together as kind of like a review, and also from the perspective from the community, basically. But there's sadly not a nice review that connects all the dots. So also because most of the things I actually found has been studied in the last 5 years. So I think we will see more and more in the next few years.
That will be exciting times for this research field. How can people find you if they have more questions? Because I see many more questions.
I'll wait here and... or at the screen printing. Let's meet at the screen printing booth, actually, next to Hall 1. I'll be there and happy to connect you and answer questions.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.